Hi, Sumaino. I'm delighted to be a part of your project today and to be talking with you about mental health. And I thought I'd just start by saying a little bit about myself, and then we'll lead into the main topic of thinking about anxiety. So I've been working for about 40 years, a long time, in the field of counseling and mental health and well-being. And over that time, I've worked with all ages. I had a position for many years in an elementary school working with families and children. I also worked with a child and youth mental health government agency where we were looking at suicide prevention and all kinds of mental health issues. And again, helping children, youth, and their parents to find strategies for dealing with mental health issues they were facing. The last 20 years has been mainly university students, so both in Canada and in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, and now a little bit of a project I'm doing in Afghanistan is really focused on that really interesting age group of kind of, I think of it as about 16 to 25 aged people. And I think anxiety is really interesting in that age group because it's such a pivotal time of life where you're trying to sometimes end high school and decide where you're going to go to university. You're individuating, which means you're trying to decide what things from my family and culture really matter to me and which things do I maybe disagree with, or which things are my individual choice moving forward. So it's just a very vulnerable time of life. And I think that's when sometimes anxiety can be a challenge that many, many humans deal with. So I guess what I'd like to say first is that we all have anxiety at different points. And it's a word that's used to say, oh, I'm anxious, an exam's coming up, or I'm anxious because there's a job interview. So there's times where we all feel anxious and we worry. When it starts to be of more concern is when it's really starting to impact your life in some way. So most of us get anxious and our nervous system gets amped up. We get extra hormones of cortisol and adrenaline, which are the stress hormones, because we're worried about something or we want to do really well at something. But then that event passes, you give your speech or you write your quiz or you go on your first date, whatever those things are, and then your nervous system comes back to some kind of baseline and you're coping with your life. What happens with anxiety is when you don't come back to a kind of a calm again. You don't complete that cycle of being worried or anxious and then come back and get a good night's sleep or do something fun and you kind of are back to normal. You stay at that really heightened level and your brain feels like you're in danger, even though the situation may not warrant that degree of panic. So some of the symptoms I would be checking with if somebody came in to talk to me is sort of the level of their fear. With anxiety, there's often this constant level of feeling like something bad is going to happen, or fear of failure, or just this, yeah, sometimes we call it hypervigilance. You're always just ready for something bad to happen. And again, some of that can be normal, and especially if you've come from either a family or a community where there's been dangerous things going on, it's our way of surviving as humans is to have that kind of awareness of safety. But if it's there all the time, then it'll be starting to impact your sleeping. So if someone for a long period of time is waking up and worrying and not sleeping, then has impact on your relationships. Sometimes you're more irritable and angry. Because you're worrying a lot, you may have rapid heart rate you're not able to kind of bring it down. your muscles can be really tense. So to differentiate between just normal anxiety and worrying about life and where it starts to be more of a mental health concern is how long it's been going on for. If it's going on for several weeks and you're really not sleeping and you're not able to concentrate, that's a worry. And just how much it's impacting your life, because we've all experienced sometimes is when something upsets us, then we try to avoid that thing. And so if the anxiety is meaning that you're avoiding all these triggers, it also means you're really minimizing some of your options in life. The most common anxiety in sort of the mental health manual, so the DSM-4 is what's used for looking at a diagnosis. And I'm not a psychiatrist who would look at it as a medical diagnosis, but still I would use it sometimes to try and help someone understand themselves. So generalized anxiety is considered the most common mental health problem in the world and among students as well. And one of the cool things about it is it's also the most treatable. There really are strategies and approaches that really help with it. So generalized anxiety is the things that we've already been talking about, a lot of difficulty with sleeping, sometimes with eating, with excessive worrying, all those kind of general anxiety symptoms. And then some of the other things would be social anxiety. So really a fear of interacting with other people, becoming more and more isolated because you worry about saying the wrong thing or not being included. So social anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder is one angle on society where there's the way of coping with this sort of fear or uncertainty is having these thoughts, often either thoughts or behaviors that you think will control your environment or your world or your reality. And so OCD is one kind of anxiety. And then there's panic attacks and it's anxiety where your whole body starts to, your heart rate goes really intensely fast, you're breathing, and there's sometimes nearly a feeling of a loss of consciousness, like people are often sweating really hard, they can't remember after a panic attack. So that would be some of the more serious forms. And then to some extent, post-traumatic stress disorder has components of anxiety as well, because it's people that have been through a real traumatic event and then they're dealing with a lot of the symptoms later of flashbacks, but also there's all those compulsive thoughts and the excessive worrying and the sleep disturbances. So a lot of these things kind of overlap with each other. So I always really think that the starting point for anything is self-awareness, and sometimes that can be helpful with a counselor to talk about what's going on. And often by the time someone makes an appointment or phones and said, I think I need help, they've come to this place in themselves where they feel like, this kind of worrying is really starting to impact my life. I'm really not functioning as well as I used to. So that it can be with a counselor. Sometimes a lot of writing and journaling can help a person to really notice what are the triggers, what are the things happening. But I'd say that the very first step is this stopping, pausing, reflecting, and part of that is self-compassion, you know, not blaming yourself and feeling like, I've messed up again, what's wrong with me? It's this kindness to yourself, is just saying, so that your self-talk needs to have a flavor of curiosity. And so I really feel like the very first step is just kind of this sometimes people call it the sacred pause, like just taking the time out of your busy life to pause, to reflect, to notice your body, your breath, your thoughts, your feelings, and that kind of self-talk of saying, hey, I'm having a rough time. What's going on right now? And I think that's a really important part of any mental health journey. And I would say all of us are on a mental health journey. You know, we're all trying to figure out what gives us a sense of well-being, where we feel like we're handling the things in our lives and having joy and having curiosity and interest. So that would be my first part. And then with anxiety, you're often trying to look at both your body and your body's reactions, and then also your mind and your thoughts. So with the body, one of our most valuable tools that we really underappreciate is our breathing. And I don't know if you can notice, but I'm quite often in this thing, I'll put my hand on my chest, because sometimes just that touch of noticing your breath going in and out. And you might want to try with me, Sumaino. Why don't we do this together, and the listeners of the podcast can try as well. So what happens when we're anxious is that our breath comes into the top part of our lungs, and we're not often getting enough oxygen to our brain. So I often just get someone to put their hand just sort of above their heart to notice, and then you could put your other hand down on your belly. And so what you're going to do right now is close your eyes for a moment and just notice your breath going in and out. Now we're going to bring the breath a bit deeper, so that when you breathe in through your nose, breathe deep into your belly for the count of four. So I'm going to lead you through an exercise called box breathing, and it's just a way of really slowing down your whole nervous system. So you're going to breathe in through your nose to the count of four, pause for four, let out the breath for four, and pause for four. So if you ever want to look online, there's all kinds of graphics that show the box going up, across, out, pause. So let's just try it. So we're going to breathe in, two, three, four, pause. Release, two, three, four, pause, two, three, four, breathe in, pause, release the air. Okay, we'll stop there. How do you feel?
It feels so good. And you know, I know about this exercise from Jay Shetty's book, Think Like a Monk. Yeah. I don't know if you have read this book. So yeah, he exactly talks about how our breath is there. I mean, breathing is really important in controlling your mind and body.
Yeah. And I can even feel just doing those two cycles that, you know, I feel a little calmer. And I think it's partly we're trusting our body. We're coming, instead of in the racing thoughts of what if I say the wrong thing, or what if this happens, or what if that happens? Like, anxiety is a lot based on the future quite often, like worrying about what if I do the wrong thing, or what if this happens or that happens. And when you're breathing, you're very present. So it's part of a mindfulness practice. And you mentioned the monk, and I think the Buddhists were especially, they were nearly like mind scientists at really looking at how noticing our body and our breath and our thoughts is how we find this deeper awareness and also how to come back to that baseline where our mind and heart rate are in some kind of synchronized harmony. And that's where we seem to be at our most compassionate and our most effective in the world. Because when we're really anxious, it's quite a self-centered way of being in some ways, because we're often really worried about ourselves. Am I going to be good enough? Am I going to pass this test? And when you calm your breath down, you've just got more openness and bandwidth for also interacting with others. And so that's an interesting part as well. So that would be my anchoring thing with anxiety is the pause, some reflection, then coming into our body. And just to add one other thing to breathing, for people that are really having a panic attack, sometimes putting a little bit more time on the out breath has been shown to help really, again, to bring the body down. So it would, there's another breathing pattern that's used sometimes that people could experiment with, where you breathe into the count of three, you hold for the count of seven, and you breathe out to the count of eight. So it's a really long, and you can breathe out through your mouth, nearly like a sigh. So it's, and you relax your shoulders, you relax your jaw, and you breathe out as far as you can, so that then when you breathe in again, your lungs are empty of all the old air and you're bringing fresh oxygen in. And that really helps to just calm your whole body and mind. So that, again, these are things you can easily look up on the internet. So one is called the box breathing, and one is this 4-7-8 pattern. And there's a lot of research behind these. So they're just easy tools. Just a couple other things with the body. Exercise is really great for all levels of anxiety. Your heart is beating, you get fresh oxygen again. So cardio kinds of exercise can be really helpful. And I mean, some researchers have said if they could bottle the overall effects of exercise, they would be very, very wealthy, because it helps with all kinds of mental health disorders, as well as cardiovascular heart issues and cancer. And I mean, there's just on so many levels, trying to get exercise as a regular part of your week is really helpful. And one friend of mine who is a nurse educator, one of our students at the University of Central Asia once asked her, what's the best exercise I can do for my stress and for my weight and for my mental health? And Marianne Morris said, well, sweetheart, the best exercise you can do is the one you will do. So it's fine, you know, because I think if you don't like running, then don't run. Find something that you that fits with your life and your hopefully something you enjoy. Like for me, walking is something that I because I love nature as well, and nature is, it also helps with our stress and anxiety. So for me, walking is usually a joy, and that maybe it's soccer or maybe it's yoga or dancing, I think is amazing, because with dancing, you're getting social needs met often. You've got music that's also good for the brain. So yeah, finding that kind of exercise that you can build regularly into your overall life. And I know it's hard because people are so busy, and I think students especially, you don't always have a predictable schedule and you've got all these assignments due. And so my other tip with that is, if you can find a buddy, a friend that wants to go for regular walks with you, or go to the gym, or go to a dance class, or there's something about knowing someone else is waiting for you that helps you stick with that more than you needing to depend on your own sort of motivation. So having either a friend or a small group of people you do it with helps meet some of those needs. A huge European study said that when they looked at the well-being, and it was over, I think, 30 countries and millions of people, the five elements they found that most showed up as the significant factors in people that felt this real sense of feeling good about their life and feeling healthy. And one was connection with other people. One was that they moved their bodies in some way or another. Another they called taking notice. And I think of it as sort of mindfulness, noticing beauty, noticing nature, noticing art and just that sense of being aware and being in the present moment. Another is giving to others. And the last one is learning something new. So, you know, I think when I went to a wedding, say in Korog, and everybody was dancing, I was getting all of those things met. Like I was with other people. So there's that sense of connection and community. It was a sort of spiritual experience, the taking notice, like the color of the atlas and the beautiful Pamiri hat, and then the sense of you're giving to others even through dancing, you're kind of communicating, you're learning about the culture. And so, for me, those were really an amazing sense of community. And I think it's also a real sense of well-being. So if you were feeling anxious and really worrying about your exams or worrying about your family's finances, you go to an event like that and you feel that community support and the beauty of the music and the movement, I think is a very healing part that community can play in helping with people's mental health.
Yeah, very agree, especially as you mentioned about peer help. I think this is very important, and it really, for example, if you want to do something that you really don't like to do it alone, so if you have a friend or you have a classmate, let's say a course mate, that wants or wills to do it with you, it becomes more enjoyable and it really encourages you to do something. And I think this peer help, peer support also helps most of the time during this.
Yes, and you know, we were just using the example of dance and Pamiri culture, but I think every culture and every community has its own ways of helping each other. And sometimes it's simple things like touch. If somebody's really feeling scared and anxious, sometimes, you know, I sometimes will encourage people to just rub cream on their own hands and to come into the moment feeling their own skin. But also if you've got a friend that can give you a good hug, or you've got a pet, a dog or a cat that you can pet and touch, and all those things kind of bring you back to the moment as opposed to the racing worries in your mind. And so, I think for each community or neighborhood, it's finding what are the things that really help them to feel grounded. And I think for some people, really sharing a meal together too, like cutting the vegetables, making a nice soup, sitting down and eating together, those kinds of things that sometimes we start to lose in our modern society. But I think those are all things that help us to feel really grounded. And the word grounded to me kind of connected to the earth, connected to the reality of the taste of our food, the feeling of the air on our skin. Music is part of that kind of our senses. So coming to the senses of what we see and taste and smell and hear, all those things help ground us in our bodies, because anxiety is so much about these thoughts that are kind of out of control and the worrying. The first part is for the social workers themselves to have their own well-being plans for themselves, because if they are really stressed, that then passes on to other people. And I know they can have really tough jobs and a lot of really sometimes painful and difficult situations they're dealing with. So I think for them to have good sleep and good sense of social connection and exercise and you know, those kinds of self-care things are really important for them to have as their foundation, because it's really hard to be there and present for others if you've got a lot of your own stress and worries. And of course there'll be good days and bad days for all of us, but that would be my first step. The other is, I really feel like relationships are the foundation of starting to be able to support someone. And I think that includes things like in a school or in a community center, that when people walk in, people welcome them. There's a sense of warmth and acceptance when somebody walks into a classroom or into a place, so that person feels, oh, I'm welcome here, I'm included, they care about my progress. So trying to create that kind of welcoming environment, I think, is one of the real challenges, and something both in my work in Canada and the University of Central Asia, we tried to look at when people arrive, how do we create a really welcoming atmosphere? So that would be another part. And then the other is really trying to find the student that you're talking with. So if I'm a social worker talking with a student, they might not be ready to think about box breathing. You know, you might need to be starting right where they are. What are they doing already that works for them? And so maybe they love listening to rap music, or maybe they have friends they play basketball with, and really trying to build on some of the habits they already have that are helpful, and to identify the resources. So I find that's a really good starting point, because it's not focusing on their deficits or the things they're doing wrong. It's focusing on, what are you doing right? What are the things that are already there that maybe you could do a little bit more of? And then trying to assess their readiness. Do they want to learn more strategies? Because then you could be starting to look at some of the things we talked about today, breathing techniques. But some of the things we haven't talked about very much is also really addressing your thoughts, really noticing what are these sort of thought cycles you go into that get you more and more anxious, and how can you gently challenge some of those thoughts that may not be based in reality. You know, like you may have this thought, oh, I didn't do well on that quiz, I'm a failure, I'm terrible at math, I'm going to fail university, I'm going to be a failure in life. You know, so sometimes our thoughts can take these really negative streams. And so one of the strategies is really starting to write down the thoughts, and nearly like a lawyer, look at it. Is this true that you're a failure? Is it true that you're terrible at math? And so that's another kind of strategy along the way that can be helpful. But what I'd say to those social workers first is build a relationship with the person, so that they grow to trust you and find out, are they ready? Are they able at this point in their life to bring in some new strategies, or do you need to really help them see the things they're already doing right and help them? And sometimes it's even just normalizing. Yeah, like everybody goes through this when they're trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, and they're trying to juggle working and helping their family and getting good marks, and, you know, like trying to help them see that this is a really, anxiety is a normal response right now to a very complicated world. And there are some small baby steps that might just help you feel a bit more settled.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Robin. Thanks a lot. I think with that, my questions finished. I don't have any other question. Just want to take the time and thank you for taking your time coming here for an amazing conversation talk that you just had with us. And yes, I hope the information that you gave somehow can help, if not all of them, but at least one in a tenth, right? This is also a result and achievement. Thank you for taking your time and coming here.
Oh, you're most welcome. I enjoyed it too.